It's really easy to make a prediction. It's really hard to make a prediction that's right.
It took your breath for a minute.
Yeah, I was like, and then I was like, oh my God, this is really happening. And before I knew it, it was over. It was sad. This is crazy. This is so nuts.
I'm Letitia Ferrer.
And I'm Chris Alexander.
And this is Totality Talks, the Solar Eclipse podcast.
It just took my breath away, the whole thing. It's really cool that you can see the corona and you see the sun kind of spewing out from behind the moon. It literally took our breath away.
A lot of people said overrated, but that was like not one of the coolest
rated.
Things I've ever
not
seen.
Not overrated.
Welcome back to Totality Talks. We've made it to our 10th episode, and thank you all for the support. At 10 days out from Totality, we chat with Canadian eclipse climatologist and meteorologist Jay Anderson. He's the creator of eclipsophile.com, which is the standard for eclipse trip planning. We discuss his journey, solar eclipse weather, and provide helpful guidance as we move from climate predictions into weather models for the upcoming event. We dive right into our chat with Jay.
So first off, I want to say thank you, Jay, for joining us, the Eclipse Weatherman. For how long?
You know, I wrote my first study of weather for an eclipse in time for the 1979 eclipse. So I would have been late 1978. Wow. I wrote the first one.
Wow.
That's... I don't even have a copy of it anymore. It was kind of a little document the place I was working with put out as a kind of a technical note. And boy, is that ever a long way in the past.
Wow. Well, I know that I didn't realize it was that early on because I thought I had seen a weather prediction from you. And I think I still have it in a magazine from 1991. And that was my first eclipse.
Yeah, 91... that was midway through it. That's about when I joined up with Fred Espenac to do eclipse circulars, actually, through NASA. It was around about that time. But 91 was that big one in Mexico that everybody went down to see. That was a wonderful eclipse.
It was. Did you go to La Paz or Mexico?
I was in La Paz.
You were in La Paz, okay.
I was in La Paz. We weren't on the center line, which was a good thing because they were clouded out a little bit.
Ooh, okay. Well, I got to see it from just north of Puerto Vallarta. And when you look on the map, it looks like it was very much almost at center point.
You were pretty close to it. I think you were just a few kilometers to the south of it.
Yep, I think so. It's 1979. And then you hooked up with Fred on doing the eclipse bulletins. That's awesome.
Yeah, that from 1979, or actually about 1983 onward until the early 90s, I would write these studies up, and they were published in the circulars of the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington. So they basically would put out a circular for every total eclipse. And for an annular eclipse, if it was over the United States, and they asked me to do a weather study for each one of them. So initially, it was almost a fun project in a way. In those days, all the maps were drawn by hand, and I had drafting tables and all kinds of ink pens and everything else, and searching libraries everywhere I went to try and find data that I could use in these circulars, especially cloud cover data, which is sort of a neglected parameter when people come to observe things in the weather. It's important to aviation, but as soon as the plane has landed, it stops being important. So, yeah, it was the first two decades were pretty much, or a decade and a half were pretty much done with pen and ink. And even the early days with Fred, we didn't start into the computerized part of it until into 2000 or thereabouts.
Wow. That's amazing that I didn't realize you were using pen and ink for all those predictions. Well, how have you gone back and looked at your predictions from back then to see how you did?
Well, I lived them for the most part. I didn't go to all the eclipses at the start, but pretty much went to all of them afterwards. So, I was reading my own predictions while I was standing there looking at the cloud or clear skies at an eclipse and thinking, well, this one worked out the way climatology said it should, and this one sure didn't work out like that. So some of them are, you know, it looked like they took a measurement of what cloud should be, and that's what kind of cloud they gave you. But so it's you know, the old saying about climatology being what's expected and weather what you get. Well, it's sometimes the weather comes up as climatology.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about your background and where you're from and how you progressed.
Well, I have a degree in physics and astronomy from the University of British Columbia. Graduated there in about 1973. And later on, and I was in my early 40s, went and got a master's degree in environmental sciences. And in between, when I graduated from university, I went to and joined the weather office in Canada at the time. And it was called the Meteorological Service of Canada. And they sent me down to Toronto to take a year of training to be a meteorologist. And the reason for the physics degree was so I could understand the math, and then wasn't much use in being a weather forecaster, but they took that and put it into me in that year. And then I was transferred to Winnipeg. They had the scheme where you could ask where you wanted to work. So I put down three cities in Canada I'd like to work. And they sent me the one that I hadn't put down. So I moved to Winnipeg in 73, the end of the year, and pretty much worked most of my 34-year career here, with 3 years off and on the West Coast as a marine forecaster and satellite expert, and scattered other places around the country. Churchill in the north was one of them, that sort of thing. But it was lucky in a way, because the 1979 eclipse went right over top of Winnipeg. So I saw that one coming a few years ahead of time, and just wondered for my own information, you know, where should I go and watch this thing? Is there a place I can go that's got better weather chances? So dug out all the information, which was easier for me because working for a weather agency, I had access to their data sets. But most of those data sets resided in Toronto. But there were enough training courses for me that I got down to Toronto sort of every year, every 6 months, and I could go hit this big library full of treasure trove of weather data. And so I was able to put these things together. The first one after 79 was actually for New Guinea and areas in there. And that was in response to a request from a friend of mine in the planetarium business who was thinking of taking a tour group there.
So I'm curious, did you see the ones in 70 and 72 that went through Nova Scotia and the eastern part of Canada?
You know, I didn't see those. I was certainly aware of them because I've been an amateur astronomer since I was about 14 or something like that. And somebody showed me the planets through a telescope, and I got kind of captivated. But in those days, 1970, yeah, I was going to university at the time. Nobody had any money to travel.
Nobody had money. You never have money in university.
Yeah. My brother-in-law went to the 73 one. He got clouded out, sort of thinking. I wasn't aware I was going to be a meteorologist at that time, or at least in 70, but I thought that would have been rather poor chance. I've looked at the satellite pictures since, and had I been forecasting for that area, it would have been a total bust for everybody.
Well, I have to go back and read your publications now and not say clouded out, but say clouded out.
Clouded out.
I've been reading it wrong.
Clouded out.
So did you put Calgary, Alberta down as one of your towns that you wanted to work in or live in?
What did I put down? I put down Vancouver, but I, of course, come out of university there and met and married my wife there. So it was a town for both of us. And I believe I put down Halifax, which it was just sort of totally foreign to anything I'd lived in Canada before. I was an army brat, yeah. So I had actually lived in a number of places all across the country and in Europe while following my dad around as they posted him from one location to the other. And I've forgotten what the third location was, but I suspect it was Edmonton, not Calgary.
I lived in Calgary for a couple of years in the 90s.
I lived in Calgary, too, and I remember it as a very fun place, too, but I was 6 years old. So.
That's great. I was checking out your article from, Sky and Telescope of 5 days ago that was talking about we're beyond the climate part now, and we're moving into the weather part. And I found it a fascinating article. I'd love for you to go through the, you know, when do we, can we actually start focusing on the weather?
You know, that article had a map of February cloudiness and it looked good, but you know, it's still climatology when you're looking at February. You're still only 6 weeks away and yet it's not a forecast. And in fact, there's some things I've been looking at that I'm getting a little concerned about that seem to be a sort of characteristic of the season. In general, I've been checking out the jet stream flow across Mexico and into southern Texas and comparing it to previous years. There's been a lot of cloud in the jet stream flowing over Mexico in the last month and a half. And so I go back to other years and find that it just wasn't like this. And I'm hoping that this characteristic doesn't linger into April the 8th, but the high-level cloud that comes in on the jet stream flow in central Mexico is a big concern. In Texas, the concern is more the low-level cloud that flows in off the Gulf of Mexico, but you know, it's also got to contend with this high-level stuff too, and cold fronts that sweep down out of the north. So Texas has got three things that are aimed at it, and Mexico's only got the jet stream stuff that's aimed at it. So it makes life a little simpler if you're down in Mexico. But, you know, cloud is cloud no matter what level it's at. So you just don't want any kind of it. I'm really hoping we get one of those eclipses where skies are clear just about everywhere, which is pretty similar to what it was like that 2 years ago. You know, that in fact, the only place that had cloud was in Texas.
There were high clouds. There were high clouds.
They were high clouds. So, you know, an eclipse through high clouds is still an eclipse and it's still marvelous and it's still that great experience that's going to be something you probably don't see again in your life unless you actually go actively looking for it.
Let's see, hunt them down. Well, AccuWeather on March 8th said it was looking pretty good for April 8th. They were doing the 1 month prediction out. So.
Well, let's see. You know, it's really easy to make a prediction. It's really hard to make a prediction that's right.
Unless you're a magician and you stack the deck.
I mean, I know of computer models that go out for 30 days, and I'm just not going to give myself the grief of looking at them and then looking day after day to see, is it still the same? Is it still the same? Because I just know these things don't work. You know, I chase storms when I'm looking at 4-hour weather forecasts, and there are times I'm shaking my head on a 4-hour forecast. So a 30-day forecast looks ambitious, let's just say that.
Well, the other day we were planning for, I'm part of the Citizen Cape program, where we're putting up telescopes, 39 telescopes all across the United States, 35 all across the United States. And we were looking at the weather forecast because we wanted to get sun so we could do our practice on focusing on the sun and everything. And the weather here in Texas, you know, 2 weeks out, it was going to be cloudy and rainy. 1 week out, it was going to be clear. And then 3 days before, it was going to be light clouds. And it was being patchy clouds, but we got some sun, but still it was just iffy. It was Texas.
Yeah, well, everywhere I go, people bring up that old saw that if you don't like the weather, wait an hour. And that's, but the only places you don't hear it are places in the Sahara where wait an hour and you'll have a dust storm, and wait another hour and it'll be gone. So it's, I've been working on the 2027 eclipse, and there's some places where there's virtually no possibility of cloud, but the dust is something that you couldn't be having to watch out for.
So what credentials do you hold exactly? Because you worked for the National Weather Service in Canada. You've been doing these eclipse bulletins, or you were doing the eclipse bulletins with Fred.
Well, officially I'm a retired forecaster, but you know, forecasting is like bicycle riding. You don't forget just because you're not collecting a daily paycheck. So I'm still a meteorologist. I have a degree in what they call natural resource management, which is sort of tied into my association with what's now called Environment Canada. Of course, I have a physics and astronomy degree from UBC. A lot of experience as an amateur astronomer and a lot of experience, well, now 45 plus years of looking at global climatology and all these things. But also become fairly expert at map making along the way because it was necessary for what I'm doing once I went online. And I'm a bit of a worm when it comes to digging weather data off the internet and finding it in obscure places. And the problem with internet weather data is that you can find a lot of it. And if you go to some place like Dallas and say, okay, how much cloud do they have in Dallas? You'll get five different answers from five different sources. So you have to go and find the original source. And so it's mostly, well, of course, I guess I'm pretty experienced in eclipses now, but it's mostly just a lifetime of working in this subject and starting with the background knowledge to know what it was you were dealing with. And so it's been a magical combination for me of meteorology and astronomy, and in particular meteorology and eclipses. They just fit together so nicely that because meteorology and cloud cover in particular is so important for viewing these events.
Well, I know it's been magical for the eclipse community. In fact, I heard that of the 11 cruise boats that went to Antarctica, only one got to see totality, and it was the one you were on.
There was a lot of luck in that. I mean, the day before, I did ask the boat to divert 50 nautical miles farther to the north to put us into a more certain area to see good weather. But, you know, half hour before we watched that eclipse at sunrise, which is something I always wanted to do. You know, that was about my 23rd eclipse, and I always wanted to see one at sunrise. And this was at sunrise. So about, I don't know, 15 minutes before the sun came over the horizon, and it came over as that very thin crescent, a Cheshire cat smile. I had turned the ship around, I went racing up to the bridge, and I shouted out, "Turn your ship around, turn," because we were sailing into the clouds. And I guess it was the first mate on duty, and he kind of looked at me as like,
"Wow,
who the heck are you?" So I went back down and I found the tour manager and said, "Look, we have to turn this around. In the meantime, the horizon is getting smaller and smaller." So
smaller.
He promptly called the bridge. He turned it around. Everybody who was on one side of the ship had to go to the other side of the ship. But nobody has any big fancy setups on a ship. And sure enough, it came up. Watched the eclipse through that wonderful gap right along the horizon, and then about 5 minutes after totality was over, it disappeared into the clouds and was gone for the rest of the day. So, you know, I have always maintained that clouds make an eclipse because they make the sky more interesting. And the one caveat being is that you can't have a cloud in front of the sun. But certainly eclipsescapes, you know, those landscape pictures of the eclipse look so much better when you've got the drama of clouds in the sky as well. And so in this case, boy, that is one heck of a dramatic picture showing that solar eclipse hugging the horizon with a cloud band right above it.
Yep. I have to agree with you. Some of my best pictures from my husband's taken at eclipses, and the few that I've taken have clouds in it, because like China in 2008 had spotty clouds, and they were just kept moving in front of the sun all through up until totality, and then they broke up.
Yeah, we had a little more trouble in China, but even there we still managed to break a hole into the clouds and watched it through clouds, but we did see the eclipse. It was...
So where were you in China for 2008?
It was supposed to be up near Shanghai. But in the end, if I've got the eclipse right, there were two of them. One
2009 was Shanghai.
Yeah.
So 2008 was the one in the west.
That's right. 8, I went to Russia. 9 was, so I moved. I could see in the forecast that it was going to be cloudy at the site we had chosen near Shanghai. So we moved about, I guess, 200 kilometers farther south, maybe even a little more. Found a nice little truck stop to set up at. And truck stop in China is not like one here, because they cater to a much larger group of people. So we pulled in there. We had 9 busloads full of people that I was helping out. And while we were parked there, 3 other busloads, one from Norway, and I forget where the other two were from, pulled in beside us, and I sort of figured, well, if there's eclipse chasers here, there must be a reason. So we all set up for this eclipse, and the cloud came in and actually started to rain. It looked like we were pretty desperate. A lot of folks went to the restaurant and decided that they would just come out and see it get dark. And then it opened up. The police came along and told us we couldn't stay there. But we actually were lucky. We had a television crew from a news station in Shanghai that had found us, and they pulled out the camera and interviewed the policeman in charge. And after that, there was no problem staying at the site and watching the eclipse. And in fact, a few other police units came in and watched it with us. So it's something that's happened in the past. So anyway, it looked like a lost cause, but about 5-10 minutes before totality, it started to thin out, and it lasted until about 5 minutes after totality, with one period of about a minute in the middle when a band of cloud went over and we lost sight of the sun. I've missed a few eclipses in my life, but that one was the closest call I ever had.
Wow. Wow. That's a great story, though, especially in China.
Yeah, China was a marvelous country to tour in, and lots of stuff to see there. But then, you know, everywhere is, you know, look around. That's one of the characteristics about going to eclipses, is that you can't wait for them to come to you. You have to go to them. And that means going to Egypt or going to South Africa or going to Australia. Well, hey, that's a bonus. just gets a little expensive along the way. That's all.
Amen. It's very expensive along the way. I can't retire. All my friends are retiring, but I can't retire. But that's okay. I like what I do for work.
Well, we've got 4 eclipses coming up in Australia in the next 6 or 7 years after this one's over, 8 years. So the Australians are going to luck in on this one. America's been lucky. It's had 3 eclipses since 2017, or is the 3rd one since 2017. So now it's going to be somebody else's turn.
Yeah.
Argentina had a good run there.
Yeah. Unfortunately, COVID got into a bit of that. So I missed one down there because of.
Well,
Chris.
That's where I met with Patricia.
Yeah, that's Chris and I both got in on that one. There was one tour group, Astro Trails. You might have used them in the past before, but Astro Trails lobbied and got 100 eclipse visas. So Chris and I were able to get in on that one. And we got to see it from the most unusual place I've ever been for an eclipse viewing, which is a horse pasture.
Okay. Any horses?
There were horses.
And what did they do during the eclipse?
And yes, and they pushed them off to the side so that we could have their paddock. But yeah, there was lots of evidence of horses everywhere. You just couldn't avoid it.
Yeah, meadow muffins.
Yeah, meadow muffins. It was challenging. But Chris Gurley got a great picture because we had a cloud. If you look at my video, I'm screaming through it. A cloud moved in just before totality.
Okay.
And what ended up happening is that it created a rainbow effect around the eclipse.
We had concentric rainbows.
Okay, so that's interesting. You know, I often find that during an eclipse, especially if you have something like cumulus clouds, you'll very often get a lot of iridescence in the clouds, as if having that very thin crescent of the sun somehow improves the optics, so to speak. I've talked to people who are experts in that, and they say that they're not aware of anything that would make iridescence more frequent or a little easier to obtain. But it certainly is one of those things that you look for if you're bored on the last 10 minutes going into an eclipse. As a meteorologist, I notice these things, but I don't think very many other people do.
Boredom 10 minutes before totality. That's an interesting concept right there.
Yeah, I haven't found...
So when was your first eclipse that you saw? Was it the 79?
It was the 79. I made sure I had the day off in the weather office. I know a lot of people came to Winnipeg partly to go to other sites out of Winnipeg, but they could have stayed in the city to watch it. And I decided to head to the center line. So I drove about, I don't know, close to 100 kilometers out of the city and found a spot in the center line with my brother-in-law in the middle of a side of a road in the middle of a farmland. And it was thin cirrus, although not particularly noticeable. You know, your focus is so strong on the eclipse that you lose sight of what's happening around you unless you deliberately take a deep breath, stop, and look. And being the first eclipse, you don't know to look for shadow bands or watch the shadow coming in or, you know, look for, well, there's a dozen phenomena that happen. You know, the beads happen, but you're focused on the first appearances of the chromosphere and the appearance of the corona and that sort of thing. And so when it's over, there were beads, but the diamond ring at the end is the only one of them that stands out on you. And that's really what happens to so many people at the beginning and why I say don't take photographs at the start. I don't know how many people I know who have forgotten to take the lens cap off during an eclipse because they're so captivated with what's going on visually. So, you know, you really will do yourself a big favor to just watch this thing. And if you must, draw a picture of it afterwards. My wife does that. And she has a marvelous recollection of where the plumes were in the corona and where the prominences were and where the chromosphere showed and didn't show, the diamond ring, everything. And even though she's a pretty good photographer, the real memory of the eclipse is what she writes down and draws afterwards. And I look at this and I think, you know, I was there. I didn't photograph it, but I don't remember that level of detail. I just remember being entranced by this thing.
That's with me too. I remember the prominences. I remember which clock they were at, you know, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, but it still just entrances me also.
I'm thinking maybe record yourself talking about it, but then I don't know, just the mere act of recording, it requires some attention, you know, remember to tell what you're saying instead of just looking at it and seeing it.
Well, I usually just kind of scream out what's happening.
Yeah. Well, yeah, if you're with a group, there are other people screaming things out.
10 o'clock, you'll be like, atmosphere, crumble, hey, crumble,
10 o'clock, 8:30.
Look at the prominence at 3 o'clock. Look at the one at 1 o'clock.
Yeah. In the 91 eclipse, I took Prism with me, a spectroscope, and watched the flash spectrum in the eclipse. And now I do that pretty regularly. In fact, I have made a filter that's about that big, and it has four windows in it. And one of the windows is just a regular solar filter. The other one is a diffraction grating. And the other two are polarizing filters. So I can see how the polarization changes in the corona just by going back and forth between the two polarizing filters. But the diffraction grating spreads out the light from the sun. And at those few seconds at second and third contact, only the chromosphere shows around the sun, and the spectrum changes to a series of crescents, all in different colors. So there's a crescent for deep red for hydrogen. There'll be another one in toward the sort of beyond green, another one in violet, sort of blue, and then violet for other emissions from hydrogen. There'll be emissions from sodium, from calcium, so many that there's so much color, and it's always changing, and it's only visible for the 10 or so seconds during when the chromosphere is the only thing that you can see, except for corona, of course, which is coming out at the same time. So it's just a completely different dimension. You really need a little physics in your background to understand what's happening, but that's readily enough acquired on the internet these days. So I usually recommend, if somebody's seen maybe 4 or 5 eclipses already and they want to take a challenge, that's because it does take your attention away from what's happening at those magical moments of second and third contact. But on the other hand, wow. I know the last time off the coast of Australia watching the eclipse and looking at that and sort of saying to myself, okay, now what did I see? And there were certain things I could remember, but for the most part, it was all just this magical color show that went on. So it's a completely different dimension to an eclipse, but not something for somebody going into the first one.
Yeah.
Do you ever draw it like your wife draws a corona and you draw the spectrum of the, have you ever tried to record that and catch those elements?
You know, one of the reasons I went out of eclipse photography is, first of all, it took attention away from the eclipse, but secondly, there's 1,000 other people doing that, and some of them are much better photographers or better equipment than I have, and they're always willing to give you those pictures. And
I'm with you.
Miloslav Druckmuller, who does those marvelous pictures of the corona, I mean, you can take them off his webpage. He's happy to have you use them.
He's been very generous to everyone.
So anyway, and there are people who've done video of the flash spectrum, as it's called, because it just flashes into view for the 10 seconds each time. And some kinds of eclipses, the eclipse is so very short that the corona, a chromosphere, is visible around most of the sun. So it lasts longer than 10 seconds on each time. And there is also a spectrum from the corona itself that you can see, although it's quite a bit dimmer. A lot of technical stuff in here. The main thing is that it's a huge, it's like the, you shouldn't really say this, but the eclipse is more like a black and white movie, and the flash spectrum is like a Technicolor movie of the eclipse, because it just makes everything much more brilliant.
Well, it's interesting you're saying that, because the scientific study that I'm working with on the Citizen Kate, that is one of the things they're doing, is that the cameras they're using actually polarize each of the colors all across the spectrum. So they're getting that kind of spectrum-y polarized view of the eclipse as it's happening. And they have it for the 35 stations all across the path, and they're going for a 1 hour movie of this to see how the corona changes.
That's going to be a very interesting study. I'm looking forward to seeing the results of that.
I'm looking forward to it too. I'm looking forward to seeing the results on that. All the teams are practicing really hard, trying to get the procedure down, making sure that regardless what happens, the videos they take are perfect.
Yeah. The whole process is nowadays capable of being completely automated, so that people can do a lot of very spectacular photography and watch the eclipse at the same time. It means carrying a computer with you to control a telescope. And it doesn't always work, because I was a eclipse in 2015 in Svalbard, which is an island halfway between north coast of Norway and the North Pole. And it was about minus 16 when at the start of the eclipse. It cooled down to about minus 21 or minus 22. Those are Celsius temperatures. So,
ooh.
Yeah. But an interesting thing is there were a lot of people there with computer setups to do all this photography, and the sky was just perfect. It was just so transparent. And computers will work at minus 20 because they generate heat inside, and the one thing that won't work at minus 20 is a computer screen. So if you're expecting to click here to start this sequence and click over here to do this, you don't know where the mouse is.
Ooh.
You can't see anything on the screen. So all of a sudden, with 3 minutes to go in totality, you've got this blank screen in front of you and no idea what's happening on it. So you always have to have a plan B, and plan B is a pair of binoculars strapped to your neck waiting for you to use if everything else goes wrong.
Well, somebody got some great pictures out of that, because I think it was Andreas. Somebody got some really fantastic pictures out of that one. Those were beautiful and crystal clear.
Yeah, I think the Antarctic one, if you were on the ice cap, you also had...
Yes, those two.
Get something like that as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well,
I just couldn't handle the price on that one.
Yeah, well, the folks that went there talk about it as a lifetime experience, both for the eclipse and for the place. Especially if they kicked in the extra cash to run up to the South Pole or something like that as well. It can get pretty pricey, but on the other hand, yes. I look over a list of my eclipses, and six of them have been seen in the United States over the 40-odd years. So, you know, you can be an eclipse chaser and still see a lot of eclipses in a lifetime, and for what isn't an awful lot of moving around. Now, you do have to wait till the 2040s to see the next one, but, you know, it can happen. You can, and it's really nice to see three or four of them, because you begin to appreciate the number of things that happen in the eclipse. You learn to watch for things like the shadow bands, the incoming shadow. And if you have a short eclipse, you can watch the sun move across the shadow during totality, although it shows better if you film it. But you know, the experience really helps in seeing the phenomena and diagnosing what's happening. So the things like polarization in the in the corona is, it's something you wouldn't normally think to do unless you had so many eclipses or you've had a very long eclipse. So this eclipse is reasonably long at 4.5 minutes, and there's a 5.5 minute eclipse coming in 2027. So, you know, there's times to experiment a little bit in those kinds of eclipses. But, you know, an 18-second eclipse, which is one I saw back in Ethiopia quite some time back, you don't have much time to do anything than appreciate it, and that's it.
It's gone.
It's there and it's gone, but you've got the whole eclipse experience. You've just got a kind of a short version of it, the trailer, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, I saw the 2002 was a 30-second eclipse in Australia at sunset. And the one that was hard to get to was the 2005 in the middle of the Pacific.
Yeah, well, I'm not normally, I've come to like cruise boats occasionally, you know, they, in the right venue, a cruise boat is going to take you to different places if you're going to an eclipse. So if you want to go to an eclipse in the middle of the Pacific, there's often a, you know, Tahiti or sailing out of, say, Peru or something like that, where there's other interesting things to see along the way. And certainly we've had our share of those. And in fact, one coming up in 2026 is visible over Spain, where the weather's prospects are pretty decent, and over Iceland, where it's going to be, you're going to have to manage that carefully. But there's also a number of cruise boats headed into the fjords of Greenland, where the weather prospects are actually pretty good, because the cold air coming off the Greenland ice cap tends to flush out the cloud, similar to the way a Chinook does it on the west east side of the Rocky Mountains. So,
oh, that's interesting.
So they, if you go looking online, you'll find a number of companies that are starting to advertise them. Astro Trails is one, Travel Quest is another, and probably a bunch of them. My guess is that all the cruise boats that sail that area, because they normally go to where the eclipse is visible, will be there for the eclipse. So it could be another Antarctic situation where there's 6 or 7 or 8 cruise boats all piled up in the fjord to watch the eclipse.
Probably. Well, that's the way it was for off the coast of Antigua for the Caribbean one in 98.
Yes, right.
There were like, you could see 6 other cruise boats right around you.
Well, it was a long eclipse track, but yeah, I remember that exactly. It was one where we were sailing into the eclipse track, and it seemed to be, we were under cloud, but we could see we were going to be out in the open by the time the eclipse started. But everybody got really antsy. It's, I want to be in the open now. So the captain turned the boat a little earlier, so that he got out from under the cloud sooner than he had to, just to make everybody feel a little more at ease. And, of course, you get to set up your cameras so that you're taking the long exposures just at the right part of the roll of the ship, so that it, on the pause before it starts to swing back the other way. Most of these ships are so stabilized now that you do long exposure photography off of it. The ship's deck.
Yeah, you can.
Hi, ISO, and I tried to employ a gimbal for 2021, and there were some guys from the University of Hawaii, the Solar Wind Sherpas. I imagine you know those folks, and they had a gimbal too, and a big, large camera with the iron filtration on it, double-sided, and they had issues with their gimbal as well. Because of that stabilized ship, very hard to calibrate a gimbal.
They also had a little more money than I'm going to take to. That's it. It's one thing to have all this equipment, but somebody's paying for the airfare on it.
Oh, yeah. Airfare, extra luggage fees, the extra weight.
In the good old days, you could put a 15-pound counterweight in your carry-on for your telescope. And carry the mounting in another bag, and nobody really worried about it. But you'd be caught out on that one now if you tried to sneak it in.
No,
I've 3D printed a little bracket that would hold bottles of water. And so I just get the bottles of water or beer and put them in there, and that's the counterbalance. And so, you know, just a little, yeah, it's a little bulky, but it's super lightweight.
Good idea. Duct tape on a rock works sometimes.
Yeah.
I'll have to remember that.
Totality Talks is brought to you by TexasSolarEclipses.com, where you can get the book, Texas Solar Eclipses. Learn about solar eclipse safety, the total solar eclipse in Texas of 1878, how technology influences our experience, and citizen eclipse science then and now. That's TexasSolarEclipses.com. Click the link down below.
Well, do we want to talk about eclipse weather, as in actual weather changes, let's say, on a calm day during the event? And I was curious if you had any good stories to tell about the actual eclipse weather occurring.
Well, you know, as a meteorologist, I read the textbooks and I see how cumulus clouds have their footprint on the surface. They're warm air rising. And if I'd thought about it, well, eclipse going to cool the ground a little bit. Cumulus cloud will disappear. But the first eclipse I went to after the 79 was in 83 in Indonesia, which is, has a lot of convective cloudiness, cumulus. And I was getting pretty worried. We were halfway from first to second contact, and the skies were about 80% cloudy. And 5 minutes later, it was clear. And I looked at that, and I thought, wow, that's, you know, it's one thing to develop the equations on what's happening, but it's quite another thing to realize how fast cumulus cloud disappears once that cooling starts in from the eclipse. And if you measure the temperature changes during an eclipse, about halfway through from first, second contact, you notice it start to drop. That's when humans will start to feel it, and actually the thermometer doesn't really start to see much of it until about then as well. But boy, the atmosphere certainly reacts quickly. But there are other circumstances where the cooling of the atmosphere will cause clouds to form. So I'm careful to make a distinction between someplace with a lot of stratus overcast, you know, what we would call stratocumulus, for instance, especially if it's up more than 6/10, that there's a very real risk that the little bit of cooling on the tops of those clouds during the eclipse will cause them to flatten and spread out into a stratus layer. There's also things that have happened. I haven't quite been able to explain why they happen, but so there are circumstances where cloud both forms and where it disappears. And for the most part, anything that's above the low cloud layer, cumulus, stratus, will not be much affected by the eclipse. I see some people say that cirrus will disappear a bit during the eclipse, but not altogether certain about that. Certainly, I think it disappears at night when the ground starts to cool, but not sure that the cooling in the eclipse is strong enough to affect the cirrus level. When we measure temperatures through the depth of the atmosphere during eclipse, the temperature change is really only visible for the lowest 200 meters or so of the atmosphere. Doesn't seem to extend much higher than that. But theoretically, the cooling atmosphere could sink a little bit, and that would help to dissipate some clouds. I think time frame we're looking at is too short. But we'll see. There must be 1,000 instruments going up through this eclipse in one form or another that they're going to be measuring some of these things. And America has a great history of meteorology and eclipses that extends back into the late 1800s and the early 1900s, where eclipses crossed the U.S. similar to the 2017 trend. And the Weather Service at the time made an effort to have expeditions go out and set up meteorological equipment. So in a way, with the accuracy of modeling these days and the ability of people to measure on very accurately at very many points over a wide area, I expect to see some interesting revelations come out of this current eclipse.
I'm smiling because a lot of students from Texas A&M volunteered for the Citizen Kate program. Whoop. And they're all out of the meteorology department. We were at training and they were like, okay, we need to go cover the telescopes now because that cloud's about to dump on us.
Yeah. Well, America graduates a lot more meteorologists out of the university every year than Canada does. So you have a bit of a luxury of skilled people to operate most of this equipment.
Well, I hope we have some more eclipse meteorologists in the making with this bunch. I'm hoping so.
We're going to make a lot of astronomers out of this thing, too, I think.
I hope so, too. I hope so, too. That is part of the goal.
Well, it's very interesting to go back in time and see how people responded to eclipses over time. Nowadays, we're sort of thoroughly involved and imbibed in their natural phenomena type of thing. That was something that was slow in coming on. You know, you started getting the first predictions of eclipse tracks in, 1715 is normally put out as the first one, but although I found some as early as 1605. But anyway, we get into the 1800s. The British especially would go to eclipses in Europe. They'd go to Spain and they would take their wives and their children along and their friends. And if they had a scientific expedition, your job is to take temperature readings and your job is to make sure that the telescope is pointed in the right position and that sort of thing. It wasn't really a tourism thing until you get into the late 1800s, and especially a couple of eclipses across the United States into the 1930s, where telegraphs were available and people really started to travel into, Pike's Peak to watch an eclipse and that sort of thing. There was a lady, Mabel Loomis Todd, who wrote a number of books about eclipses. She was married to a solar scientist, and she popularized eclipses at the end of the 1800s and the early 1900s. Quite a good writer. And the Victorian style, you read it now, it's marvelous language in it, but it's not the style we write in these days. And so, and then you get up into 1970, somebody had the bright idea to convince a cruise boat to sail out to an eclipse in the Atlantic. And that's, I think, is where big eclipse tourism really began. Up to that time, it was more people who were either conveniently located or who had a sort of background interest in natural things. And then now it's become pretty big tourist industry, I think. So
it's pretty interesting.
It's a big globe. There's lots of room for people to stand under a shadow. Usually, yes. Not always.
I like the fact that you mentioned the Mabel Loomis Todd book, because I did read that. For this eclipse here in Texas, I researched the one that came through Texas in 1878. Her fiance back then was in Dallas. David Todd was in Dallas for that eclipse. And what was really fascinating, back to the weather and everything else, it was July in Texas. And the report is full of the fact that the heat was horrible. They couldn't, and they were using the stars to get their location. But this is Texas in the summer. They had thunderstorms like 3 of the 5 nights. They were trying to get their location from the stars.
A lot of people thinking about that right now for the eclipse coming up in April. It could be a thunderstormy day.
I know. It's I know. We get them here.
Yeah, there's 2 other books by Mabel. One of them is called Tripoli the Mysterious, Tripoli being the capital of Libya. And she reports on 2 eclipses there. And the other one was Corona and Coronet. Coronet is the name of a yacht that somebody with a lot of money provided to her and her husband, who was a solar scientist, so provided to him. So they sailed from the Pacific coast to Japan to watch an eclipse. And the thing about Mabel's writing is that it's a travelogue. The one Tripoli, The Mysterious, is all about the high society in Tripoli among the Europeans, and includes things like French bombardment of the city and that sort of thing, when had a little bit of an argument with the pirates in that area. So she, to me, is sort of epitomizes eclipses being both the spectacle and the travel. And she had some marvelous insights about the native peoples that she encountered and their characteristics, seen through the eye of a 18th century white woman. But Mabel was also well known for curating the works of Emily Dickinson. So she had some writing bona fides that I think she really show up in her books. Intriguing reading.
I agree. It was. I only read the one. I'll have to go look at the other two.
They're not hard to find online. I think a number of them are being reprinted in sort of modern copies these days.
I got a reprint of the total eclipses, and then I think you can get it on Google as a PDF, because it was one of those books that got scanned in and put in as a PDF in Google.
Yeah, it's well out of copyright. All of them are, so certainly worth looking at, especially if you want to see the writing style of the time, which I find very engaging. They seem to have had a better command of language than, I write a lot of stuff, and I look at this and I think, oh, boy, I wish I could write like this. There's a whole culture of eclipses. You can get lost in the whole subject, and sometimes I do.
So where are you going to be? Where are you headed for this one?
Well, I'm in Torreon in Mexico, so we're very close to the maximum point there, although a little off the center line. It's part of the reasons why I'm concerned about the amount of high-level jet stream cloud that's been over top of central Mexico for the past several weeks, hoping it doesn't make its presence felt during the eclipse. But it's a good place to be, and there's a little bit of touring around. My wife and I are going to go in to have a look at Mexico City. I haven't been there since 1968, so there's a little bit to see that's changed since then.
A lot has changed, I'm sure. So what advice would you recommend for somebody who, let's say, 3 days out is trying to make their decision as to, okay, I booked 3 spots, which one do I go to?
Okay, well, at 3 days out, the computer models have some real information, I call it stuff that's likely to turn out to be right. One of the problems you run up against is there'll be a forecast on television that's somewhere was generated by a computer and probably modified by the meteorologist who's presenting it. But you're only going to get one story there. Here's the forecast for eclipse day. It's going to be clear here, cloudy there. And I think for most people, they need to know, well, how good is that? I mean, how much trust can I put in it? And so I advise people who are really determined to go and look at the original source of, in other words, the raw output from these numerical models, and to look at several of them from different models, because where they agree, they're more likely to be right. And let's face it, the goal of these models is to forecast the actual weather. So logic dictates that they will get more and more like each other as you get closer and closer to the eclipse date. But the thing is, if you look at, say, 3 models, which I wouldn't suggest anymore, you can say, well, this one says northern Texas is going to be clear. Southern Texas has got broken cloud. The next one says, well, that broken cloud's going to go almost up to the Oklahoma border, but it's going to be clear beyond that. And the third one might come in and agree with one or the other, or it might have a slightly, but there's going to be common areas where they all have a certain amount of agreement. And those are the areas you can say, those are reliable enough to start me thinking about moving to this location. Where they all disagree, you say, well, you know, it's a coin toss still in this area. So you wait till the next day. Most people who are determined to see the eclipse can get to it within 2 days.
Yeah.
So the next day they should, there's two things you look at. Do they agree with what they said the day before? And do they agree more with each other? But by that time, I think you can find enough signal in all of the noise that you could pretty reliably pick out a spot, or at least you could adjust your level of, or your tolerance for risk, let's say, you know, okay, it's 60% cloud here, but it's probably going to be cumulus cloud, or because it has been like that for the last few days, and that's going to disappear. I'm going to go there and just take that risk, because these computer models don't know the eclipse is coming. So they don't allow for that in their cloud forecast.
That's true. Do any of them?
Some smart aleck in the National Weather Service is probably going to make a computer model that has the eclipse in it. And if we're lucky, we'll see that ahead of time. But the folks on the television channels aren't dumb either. As they get closer to the eclipse, they're going to start refining. And you could change channels as long as the forecaster on one channel isn't using the same source as the forecaster on the other channel. So there's a lot of little tricks. We have a saying that if you don't like the forecast, change the channel until you get one you like. But what you want to do is change channels to see if they're all saying the same thing. And that's a little bit like comparing the models to each other.
Okay. Well, I'm actually, I think Chris that's and I are info. Both picked our spots and we're there now, right? Are you still going to?
I'm there. Going to Kerrville, Texas. Had a crazy plan to buy a refundable ticket up to Indianapolis or something. I might just wing it and use the car instead. But if we have a front that's going all the way from the southwest up to the northeast, we've got a problem.
It happened 2 years ago.
Don't say it. Yeah.
I know.
Yeah. But you know, there's...
Well, it's happening right now. So maybe we'll get right past it.
The cold front. And there's a cold front as a back edge. And you look for the spot where that back edge has just managed to squeak into the eclipse track. So you can say, well, you know, I'm going to Junction, Texas. It's close to the edge, but it's going to be outside that cold front. And or you can go find a spot in Ohio that's the same, you know. But in the end, it's going to be a lot of take what comes. So if you're going to be in one location, don't even look at the forecast. Just give yourself grief.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I hope it's. I've been just telling everybody, but we're in Texas, right? I'm just telling everybody to pray for clear skies. That's it. Well, just pray for clear skies.
That's certainly what my climatology shows, is that you have a better chance than anybody else for that. And you still run about 35%. Well, El Nino should help you. Say maybe 28%, 29%, 30% chance of cloud cover. And I'm about the same where I'm going to be in Mexico, so. Climatology only helps in long-range planning. When short-range planning, and we're getting mighty close to short-range planning now.
I think we'll be 10 days out when this episode publishes.
So 10 days is when the computer models are working.
Okay, so they start working 10 days out.
Yeah, go and look at that. I got links on my website to them if you want to not have to look for them yourselves, but have them laid out for you. So
perfect.
So which ones, we'll put them in the show notes, but which one's your favorite?
Show notes for sure.
Well, you know, the ECMWF, which is a European model, is one that is generally regarded as the best of the long range models. And it's the one I look at first. but it's a model. And we have a saying in the weather office that the models look more like each other than they do the real weather, especially when you're 10 days out. But nevertheless, it'll start to give people some ideas. And I kind of use the long-range forecast for kind of what if planning. What if this is right and I'm planning to be here? What am I going to do? And then you start thinking about how far you might have to move. But it's not until you're about 3 days out when you can start moving into the short-range models. And they aren't necessarily more accurate than the long-range ones, but the physics inside the model is a little different. It handles cloud a little differently. And more important than anything else, they usually have a higher resolution. They see finer details, especially where topography might be a problem. Things like the stratus flowing in off the Gulf of Mexico over Texas, they might be able to give you a more accurate edge on where that might be, because low cloud is difficult for models to handle. So you switch over to the short range model at that point, and the one called the NAM, the NAM or North America model, is a good one. That's an American model. There's also the RDPS, which is a Canadian model, also short range. And those two, if you've got a storm chaser friend, bring them along, because storm chasers learn how to use all these models, especially the short range ones, because they're used to watching the model hour by hour. And some of these models come out every hour. It just used to watching them and to get to the right place in a storm. They'll just be using them in reverse. They'll be trying to get the place away from the storm in case of any. But I would stick with the NAM and RDPS and don't go model crazy on these things, because they always have errors in them, but they do focus in as you get closer to the eclipse. Once you're on eclipse day, your satellite pictures are what's going to save you. Yeah. They'll tell you how far you are away from the nearest hole and which way it's moving and where you have to be.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely put the links from to your site in the show notes. And then put some of the links for your favorite models in the show notes also.
Well, one thing to realize is that the ECMWF model is the same wherever you find it on the web. The GFS model, which is the American model, it's going to be the same presentation. People will color the cloud differently. So one of the confusing things I'm finding out is that in some websites, cloudy areas are colored blue and sunny areas are colored white. So if you look quickly at this thing, you can think, oh, here's all this nice blue stuff coming in. And you read the legend on the bottom of it, because it can really fool you if you're not careful. I don't know who picked that color scheme, but it seems to me exactly the opposite of what you might want it.
They probably had to, because the other color scheme is probably copyrighted.
But then I go to another site and it's black and yellow. So maybe it is. I don't know. Yeah.
I do love the tagline on your website that is Dream Travel Explorer. You only go around once.
Yeah. Love that. In a way, I like experiences. So I chase tornadoes. My wife does too. Although I have to find her one yet. And I like to go to volcanoes that are erupting. And I like to watch meteor showers. And you get a lot of aurora where I live. So aurora is pretty common. But we'll still travel for it. And transits of Venus, transits of Mercury, we'll go do those things too. And it's just so nice to have Mother Nature giving you all these wonderful little things to look at. Going and finding meteorites, that's kind of a fun exercise. And so, take advantage of life if you can, and take advantage of Mother Nature's natural phenomena too. The wildflower blooms in California right now must be truly spectacular, and that sort of thing. So it's all happening. Just got to make an effort to go and see it.
That's awesome. So where do you go to, do you go to Oklahoma for your tornado chasing, or?
You know, we go where the weather is. Okay. We get tornadoes here in Canada, but you know, we get about 30, 40 a year. So that's pretty slim compared to the 1,100 across the central United States. So normally we'll put a group of two or three or four people together and say, okay, let's go to Nebraska for tomorrow. And when we get there, we'll look around and say, well, Iowa tomorrow, it's a little harder to chase in Iowa, too many trees. So maybe we got something in Wyoming. We'll head back to the High Plains to do it. Or we might just, we've chased as far south as Texas, and we've chased as far west as Alberta, and as far east as into Iowa, certainly. So, you know, kind of like the world is your oyster if you're storm chasing.
Because that's one of the things that's on my bucket list, is to go chase some tornadoes.
Well, you
know, and I know I have plenty of opportunity.
We're talking about traffic problems during the eclipse day. Tornado chasing's got the same kind of traffic problems. You know, I've waited 20 minutes on a side road to turn onto a main highway, waiting for the storm chasers to clear out so I could find a break in the traffic.
Yeah, my bucket list is a hurricane party. I want to, you know, my buddies ride them out, you know, when they're low category.
And well, my wife has expressed some displeasure about thoughts about going to hurricane chasing. So, and it's a long way to go from Winnipeg to the Gulf Coast or whatever to chase a hurricane. I'll go first. In the old days, I'd go for a shuttle launch, and I might go watch Elon Musk fire off something. But again, it's all experiences.
It's all experiences. It's as Kate Russo calls it, an embodied experience for the total solar eclipse. She calls it an embodied experience because you feel it above you, around you, and within you.
You know, if you go to a volcanic eruption, you're looking at somebody's grief. And if you go to a tornado chase, somebody is suffering. But you go watch a solar eclipse, nobody is suffering. It's happy people everywhere. And the beautiful thing about the eclipses is the way it bonds both people and generations together. In the 2017, ahead of 2017, I traveled the length of the solar eclipse from Oregon right over to the Carolinas. And I talked to people all along the way. And the story I heard all the time is, yeah, you know, my granddad took me out to see an eclipse when I was 6 years old. And I don't really remember much about it. And I'm thinking to myself, you take your grandchildren out to this eclipse, and 50 years down the road, they're going to think about that and tell their kids or their grandkids, yeah, your great-granddad went out with me and we watched an eclipse in 2017. Well, most people forget the year that it was. And so there's this enormous sort of linkage of generations by these eclipses. Same thing was true of Halley's Comet back in the early 1900s when it was so bright. There are people there I've talked to, and they're not too many alive anymore, but who talk about how they went out to watch that comet with a father or something. Now, usually it's a secondhand story by now, passed down by a grandchild. But those things are memories in your own mind, but they're memories that go last through time.
That's a great story. That's a great story.
Yeah. Well, this has been fascinating. Really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you so much for your time, Jay. I know you're busy this time of year or this time of season, eclipse season.
Yeah. Eclipse season, and another one coming in October to be soon.
Oh yeah.
Are you going to that one?
Yeah. I'm going to be on Easter Island for that one.
We'll see you there.
Oh, good.
Well, yeah.
It's a small place. I've been there twice before. So it's a small place. We're bound to find each other.
All right. Sounds great.
Well, it's been good talking to you.
Oh, yeah.
I'll look forward to your report from Mexico.
Okay. It'll be there. Have a good night. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Totality Talks. Hope you found our chat with Jay useful in helping your plans for April 8th. Check the links in the show notes for more information. In our next episode, we switch gears and talk with the premier creator of eclipse poster art, former astronomy professor, Tyler Nordgren. Look for a bonus episode soon after that will have the last-minute tips to help you plan for Eclipse Day 2024. As always, clear skies.